So there's this world that exists where many people really don't know much about. It's a niche of a niche, as it were, where enthusiasts spend thousands of hours searching for mistakes in code. They document every discovery. They share the techniques with people sometimes on the other side of the world. And there's a celebration at times when they uncover this new vulnerability and leverage it to do something new. But they're not your traditional hackers. They're not your traditional security researchers. They're speedrunners. Speedrunning is this practice of completing a game as fast as possible. The players, known as speedrunners, they optimize the gameplay or find bypasses in order to get through the game as fast as possible. They find these glitches, they exploit them, and they leverage them to do things that really weren't intended. Imagine playing Super Mario 64, right? And you discover that if you jump at just the right angle, facing just the right direction, the game lets you like break through a wall that you weren't meant to dive through. You find this ability to crash the game because of a memory corruption issue, and then you can leverage that in order to skip ahead to the end of the game without doing any of the content. These are not, you know, these are just clever tricks. They're essentially the same type of research that people are doing on software that you run on your computer, software that runs on your phones. They unlock the same type of vulnerabilities that professionals are looking for in critical systems. What really makes this interesting is the amount of technical depth that's involved. The speedrunners, they're analyzing game code frame by frame, instruction by instruction, and finding out how these systems operate in order to find bypasses and doing things that really weren't intended. So what's also fascinating is how these communities operate. They reverse engineer the games. They use professional tools like Binary Ninja or things that, you know, other professionals will use. And they really break down to understand just how these games operate to an excruciatingly intimate detail. And these communities are essentially performing vulnerability research as a hobby. They're developing these technical skills through their passion for gaming. Today, we're going to talk about somebody who bridges these worlds of video games and cybersecurity. He's given talks at DEF CON about his work. He's appeared at numerous conferences and online streams such as Games Done Quick. And he's helped build a robot that plays video games perfectly, and he does that for charity. It uses superhuman speed to just input controller commands that a typical person wouldn't be able to do. And it results in sometimes these crazy things. And he doesn't do it for malicious purposes. Instead of trying to troll somebody or, you know, cheat in a game, he does it to make art. And he does it to just showcase how perfectly a game can be played. And his journey shows how the same skills that people use to shave seconds off of a run can kind of result in uncovering the same types of vulnerabilities that companies around the world are facing every single day. So let's dive in. Okay, first, tell us your name and what it is that you do.
Hi, I'm Alan Cecil. I am a security consultant with Maltech Solutions, but I'm also known for being Duango AC, keeper of TaskBot Online. I do a lot of crazy things with video games being played perfectly by our cute little robotic mascot. Actually have him right here. This is TaskBot. Okay.
So tell us a little bit about like that journey into speedrunning. Did you start with video games and then going into the security components where we look into the vulnerabilities and the exploitation, the glitches, that thing? Or did you start in security and kind of integrate it with the video game stuff? Like, how did that happen?
So that's an interesting question. I actually started doing test engineering work all the way back in 2000. I know I'm old. I ended up getting into some security-related elements because I became the president of the North Bay Linux Users Group over the course of a couple of other positions that I started in over the years. I started doing that in 2003, And by 2006, I had combined those two interests to give a talk at NBLUG, the North Bay Linux Users Group, on putting Linux on an original Xbox console, which definitely required a fair bit of hackery back in the day. Was a lot of fun. Gave that talk. It was kind of my first security-oriented talk in 2006, and it just sort of grew from there. Ended up starting the TaskBot stuff in 2013, and I'll be talking more about that later. By the time I was a full security consultant or analyst, I suppose, in 2019, I'd already been doing a lot of adjacent things prior to that, but it always seemed like my testing and security consulting aspects overlapped with the video game stuff consistently.
And then like getting into the speedrunning side of it, like how did that transition and how did you get involved with things like speedrunning and the tool assisted stuff related to TaskBot? I mean, just the intro to that community, how did that come about?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So speedrunning, of course, is just playing a video game quickly. Tool-assisted speedruns are playing a video game quickly without any human limitations of skill, reflexes, luck, memory. And it kind of appeared on the scene in about 2003 with a video from someone named Morimoto who released this perfect playthrough of Super Mario Bros. 3. Mario just got really close to enemies and didn't die, got 99 lives. I saw this thing in the pre-YouTube days, and it just blew my mind. I had to know more about it and got involved in the Task Videos community over the years, started submitting tool-assisted speedruns in the aughts, as they would say, and went from there. So that got my interest in tool-assisted speedruns. The actual hacking part happened in 2013 in the sense of, well, the making a video game run on real hardware part happened in 2013 when I wanted to do something productive for charity and started looking at what I could do for Games and Quick charity events.
Now, when we talk about speedrunning and those types of things, there's, you know, like prestige behind some of this, isn't there? There's like whole communities and there's leaderboards and, you know, there's people that are known for their ability to play a game perfectly or as quickly as possible. So there's, you know, a lot of pressure that can come up with some of these things, right? To try and, you know, do better than the other person in order to have that top spot on the leaderboard. So there's, you know, that drive behind it for that notoriety, as it were, in the community. Is that the case?
So obviously, if you put humans together in any community, they always seem to want to compete. It just seems like that's what we do. And this kind of started early on with a game called Super Metroid, or actually the original Metroid, really. It would show you a timer at the end of the game to show you how quickly you completed it. And people started competing to see how quickly they could complete the game, how low they could get that timer at the end of the game. It gave you various different better endings, you might say, if you completed it quicker. And so there was already this community that had started to form even in the 90s. Doom kind of added on to that with demo files you could record, and then people started splicing those together and doing a primitive early form of tool-assisted speedruns and started competing with those, which became things like Doom Done Quick, and then, of course, it was surpassed with Doom Done Quicker, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, there's always going to be some competitiveness. Early on, there was Speed Demos Archive that came up to specifically handle speedrunning elements. There were previous competitions for just high scores, and those were more things that you would find on Twin Galaxies, stuff like the highest score in Donkey Kong or highest level in Pac-Man, things like that. So there was always going to be some amount of competition in this, but it grew. Now there are speedrun.com site leaderboards for specific games. There's Speedrun Live or SRL, various other competitions. There's even randos where people will take old video games and randomize them, and there's specific leaderboards for randomizer competitions and things like that.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it's become quite a thing.
I didn't realize there was so many different categories. I looking into it, I saw that there's different categories for how you can classify like a speed run, right? So there's the speed run playing it without abusing anything, playing it without any glitches or without bypassing anything, like beating it perfectly, completing all of the content as quickly as you can, or just beating it as fast as you can possibly get to the end, and it's allowed to skip all of those things. So what I'm really interested in is that latter part, that ability to skip through things or to, you know, abuse mechanics and stuff like that. Like, how does that kind of originate, or how do those things get found within the games themselves?
That's a great question. And kind of touching on the categories aspect you mentioned, there are a variety of different categories. Some of the categories are as straightforward as it doesn't matter how you do it or what glitches you use. It's a category for a game that's just beat it as fast as you possibly can, which can get kind of absurd for certain games. There are some that are a couple of seconds long. And usually communities will start to develop their own specific categories. For instance, in the game Super Mario 64, there is a glitch with the rabbit named Mips that allows you to get through a door and get to Bowser in only 16 stars. The game intended you to do it in 70 stars, but you could also collect all 120 stars. So there's all of these different categories for each of those specific... each game will have specific categories that are dependent on whether 100% really means just 100% of collectibles, or if 100% maybe means some collectibles, but not all collectibles. Where I'm over on the other side of it is, even within tool-assisted speedruns, there are still categories. For instance, one of the categories we have for Super Mario Bros. 3 is just called Game End Glitch. And in that category, we're abusing a specific glitch I would like to talk to you about in detail because it's just so fascinating, that allows us to complete the whole game in a few frames. It's really incredible.
Explain what you mean, a few frames.
A few video frames. Yeah. So a game like Super Mario Bros. 3 runs, at least in the United States, on an NTSC console at 60 frames a second. And every frame of video is a full display of the screen. It updates every 16.6 milliseconds, roughly every 60 times a second. We can complete the entire game and go straight to the end credits on this game in less than half a second. Wow. Just a few frames.
So let's dive into that, because there's some overlap here with security, because if you're doing something like that, you're obviously bypassing the mechanics of the game, how it's intended to be played. So in security, we have things right now where you have like collaboration with industries, with companies, or with other groups, where they, you know, find things and they reach out to the company and they basically say, hey, I found this vulnerability, here's what it can lead to, and there's like this collaborative aspect of it. I'm guessing in the video game space there's similar overlap, right? There's people that are finding these things, and then there's other people that maybe take some of that and figure out how they can leverage that in order to maybe do these types of bypasses where you're able to beat a game in half a second. Can you talk about that overlap a little bit?
That's very much the case. So first of all, touching on a little bit of skill set stuff, and this happens in the real security world too. There is no one person who has every possible skill set. And in the world of tool-assisted speedruns, largely centered on the primary site for that is taskvideos.org, where I am a senior staff member and the senior ambassador of the site. On that site, we have certain people who only work on glitch hunting. Their fascination is finding the little flaws in video games that allow it to be broken open. There are resource pages for various different beloved games that go into great detail on how certain glitches that might benefit you work. And the team of folks, the researchers and the incredible subject matter experts that do that might not necessarily be the same folks that have the patience to sit there and laboriously create a tool-assisted speedrun, which is basically a process of starting your favorite video game, say Super Mario Bros. 3, creating a save state before some difficult part, like trying to jump over a Goomba. Maybe you try jumping over the Goomba by bouncing on its head. Okay, well, that worked. Maybe you load your save state, so you go backward in time, and you try again. And this time, you do it in slow motion. You try jumping over the top of the Goomba. Okay, well, that worked. Well, maybe this time you rewind and you do it one frame at a time. You use frame advance and you perfectly time it to jump as high as you possibly can and see how fast that is. And maybe you iterate over this many, many times and you actually find that the fastest way to get through that segment of the game is to jump off of the front edge of the Goomba at just the right angle to embed Mario's head into a coin block, at which point the game tries to eject you out. And if you hold in the opposite direction it's trying to eject you, it pushes you forward in the level, saving you a couple of frames. So those are the types of patient, repetitive skills that you might need to make a tool-assisted speedrun that a glitch hunter might not be interested in doing. So yes, there's a wide variety of skills that are necessary for this.
So let's dive into that a little bit more with regards to TazBot. You mentioned before that you got started with the hackery and those types of things with the Xbox stuff. So let's get into the TazBot side of things and talk a little bit more about the tool-assisted speedruns and how that whole community started to grow, your community, your TazBot community, but just that that side of things in general.
Yeah, one of the more beloved games is Super Mario World. And in 2013, I had the opportunity to show a series of specific glitches in Super Mario World to a broader audience. There was a Games Done Quick charity event that was running, Awesome Games Done Quick 2014 in January of 2014, benefiting the Prevent Cancer Foundation. And I knew that this was coming up and I wanted to be able to show something there. Early on, I was trying to just practice playing a video game as fast as I could with human skill. I was playing around with a game called Scribblenauts Unlimited. I quickly discovered that I did not have the fast mousing skills necessary to really play that game well in front of an audience. Came back to my roots and went, oh, I wonder if there's something we could do to show a tool-assisted speedrun at a GDQ. There had been some precedent to that. There was an NES bot that was shown in summer of 2011, but it had been kind of fallen out of... it hadn't really been talked about much, and it didn't have any kind of mascot. And in 2013, I submitted content. It was accepted. I started looking for a way to make a mascot for what we were doing and came up with a Rob robot, this Nintendo Rob robot that was sold in the 1980s with some Legos and Raspberry Pi, and I called him Rob Berry Pie. And that lasted about a week. Someone's like, No, that name is dumb. Someone else popped up and said, I'm loving this TazBot action. And that name stuck. Someone named Mecha Richter on the forums just popped up with that name. And this is the new iteration of TazBot's form. This is all 3D printed, although with a lot of work. Obviously, we've put a lot of effort into making him nice and cute and have blinking eyes and whatnot. But yeah, we had our mascot and we showed off Super Mario World in ways that people had never seen before.
In fact, I actually got to see this in person because you were in my neck of the woods here on my side of the country just a couple of months ago. You brought TazBot in and we were talking about Mario World, and I had my original Super Nintendo. I had my original copy of Mario World, and I basically just put you on the spot. I said, can you show me TazBot in action with all of my gear and just your robot? And, you know, you did. I have a video. I'll share it with Danny here. It's just a short clip, but it was, you know, TazBot playing Super Mario World on my original console. And it was just crazy to watch it because what you guys did was really fantastic. You have a little LED reproduction of the controller. And as it's playing, it's showing all of the actual button inputs that are taking place. So I was able to watch, you know, TazBot execute these things at a rate that no human could possibly do. It was really cool to see it, you know, take advantage of some of those original flaws in the game in order to do things like rewrite memory, to, you know, port you to different areas, to bypass entire pieces of the game and finish it in what, like 10 minutes or something like that?
Yeah, less than 10 minutes. This is a fantastic game, by the way. It really holds its wonder even all these decades later, which it hurts to say that it's decades, but it is.
So with your work with TazBot, I know that you're in it for the not the malicious aspect as would, you know, largely or generally be attributed to, you know, hackers, people that are hacking the game. You have people that are, you know, cheating on online games or doing things like wall hacking or doing those things where you can see through where another player exists without your ability to see them. But your motivations are entirely separate from, you know, somebody that's trying to be better at a game, right? It's like, what is it that like brings you into doing these types of things?
If I understand your question right, what is it that makes me interested in hacking things?
Just in the video game side itself. So you're not in it to try and find these exploits in order to, you know, beat a bunch of people in Call of Duty and you know, trash a server or anything like that. Like, you're doing all this stuff for charity. You're showing off these games for charity. In fact, we'll talk a little bit more in a minute here about the Zelda stuff. But like, what's the motivation behind all of this?
Yeah, well, for me, it was honestly just the thrill of the hunt in some ways. It's interesting to see a video game that you love as a kid get utterly destroyed. And it's, at least for me, I started on the road just to be able to make a tool-assisted speedrun. I wasn't even thinking in terms of hacking at the time. I didn't think about that until several years later. One of the things that I was just trying to do was to manipulate the game into giving me something I wanted. My first tool-assisted speedrun was a video game called High Speed. It was a pinball simulation off of the original Nintendo Entertainment System. It was a game I had played as a kid, and I ended up buying the actual pinball machine. But I wanted to make a tool-assisted speedrun of this game. And in the game, as you do different things, it will give you random power-ups, items, basically. I discovered that if I flipped the flippers in a specific way, I could manipulate what item showed up. I wouldn't necessarily know what that item was. But if I flipped the flippers, it would just change what item would show up. So I wrote a Lua script tied into the FCEUX emulator that I was using at the time to manipulate the button presses in times where I didn't have to worry about what flipper buttons were being hit to force the pseudorandom number generator to give me a favorable result. I guess that was a form of hacking, right? I was forcing the game to give me something interesting. But that was just the start of it, right? That was just the beginning. That kind of expanded out from there, and I started to discover, oh, you can do really crazy things with this. If you'll allow me to go on a quick story of Super Mario Bros. 3.
Absolutely.
One of the most fascinating discoveries, this was not my own discovery, but it was definitely one of the most interesting ones I saw. When the original Nintendo console came out, they made a mistake. After they'd shipped all of the hardware to the United States, they discovered a flaw where if a game was asking the controller for button presses, at the same time it was playing a specific type of audio, PCM audio, playing DPCM audio samples, it could lose the button presses on the open bus. Basically, you'd just suddenly have the start button get pressed, or it would miss your jump. And that was not acceptable. So for Nintendo, after they'd already shipped the hardware, they had to come up with some way to solve the problem. And they made games themselves solve the problem in software. So for a game like Super Mario Brothers 3, what it does is it reads the controller, then it reads the controller again, and it sees if those two match. And if for some reason this bug happens and they don't match, it throws the first result away and measures it again. And in general, they're probably going to match and it moves on with life. What we discovered is that we could keep it busy by constantly sending it a different button press every single time that it asked for input. And it kept it so busy that it was unable to do any of the housekeeping it normally would have done. At a certain point, it hits what's called a non-maskable interrupt. It happens when it has to start drawing the frame of video on the screen. And at that moment, it drops to a location in memory that it's not supposed to, that it wasn't expecting to. Basically, it lands on a sled of no-op instructions and slides directly into the location where the controller buttons are. And instead of just randomly pressing buttons, we press the exact buttons that map to, in memory, the address to the end credits. And by some chance, the opcode, the byte in memory directly before the controllers, happens to be an opcode that says relative jump to the address that follows. So we literally tell the game to jump to the end credits. Obviously, the way this was discovered was a lot of research over many years, a lot of investigation to exactly how the game worked by putting it in an emulator using tools that are very similar to something like IDA Pro or Binary Ninja to analyze how the game was behaving, what was in memory at that moment, every CPU register, and be able to go across the boundaries and see where in memory things were so you knew what you needed to do. So we just discovered where the address to the end credits were and jumped to them. So you can play this game and beat it in half a second that way.
That's just crazy. All of these terms that you're throwing out there, like, you know, talking about the memory manipulation, the instructions, like that's all the same stuff that you see in typical software. So like to me, anybody that's doing this work for tool-assisted speedruns or even just finding these glitches, it sounds like the exact same stuff that you'd find in traditional software vulnerabilities that you could potentially exploit in similar ways to do things that weren't intended. I mean, I would say that that's the case, right?
Absolutely. And I would say that, again, there are different skill sets. There are people who are really good at reverse engineering. Those are the same glitch hunters in the tool-assisted speedrun space finding those glitches. And as an extension, there are people in the human RTA speedrunning scene that are doing the same thing, sometimes without tools. Sometimes they're doing it the very hard way of just bashing on a game over and over again and seeing where they can get their character out of bounds or other aspects. But you certainly have this core skill set. And in 2016, I gave a talk at DEF CON about how these people make fantastic hackers because they have the right mindset of, hey, it didn't work, try again. Hey, try something different. Think outside the box. Think in a different way than what the developer expected. Those guys are the best folks to be in a security consulting or a security environment.
Now, do you know how much overlap there is with that community in the security environment? Like, obviously, you're one case, one data point of somebody that has been in that speedrunning slash, you know, game, vulnerability identification, exploitation, but you're also in the consulting space, right? Trying to help businesses protect themselves. How common is that in the community in general? Do you know a bunch of people that are in both of those places, or do they just kind of focus on the games and maybe don't understand the opportunities that are available in like the security space?
I would say the vast majority of people in speedrunning and tool-assisted speedruns are not necessarily in security consulting or in a cybersecurity role. On the other hand, the number of people in cybersecurity roles that I have interacted with that are also interested in video games and to an extent, some element of video game hacking is actually kind of high. And this isn't exactly just me speaking. I just saw a couple of weeks ago, just last week, I think, Zetier, Z-E-T-I-E-R, released a post about how speedrunners are vulnerability researchers. So I'm not the only one who thinks this.
Yeah, no, that's why I think it's such an interesting topic to overlap those different things. But, for the audience that we're going for here, we're looking to try and like translate this into business, right? So how does the types of things that we're talking about here in video games, like what can businesses take away from the things that you're finding or the things that you're doing in the TaskBot community or in the speedrunning community to take that to heart for how they're operating on their business side or just, you know, any sort of overlap that you can think of there, you know, maybe relates to how it finds flaws in their systems or how they can, you know, just take anything out of this conversation that we've had so far.
Yeah, I would say a lot of some of the smartest businesses and business leaders I found have embraced the elements of what make hacker culture what it is. It's kind of that willingness to allow someone to try something off the beaten path. Or to put this in the context of if you're in a company that has a software development process and you have a test engineering department or maybe just a beta tester department, quality assurance, which I hate that name, but that's beside the point. If you have an environment like this, and you only allow your testers to just run through already written test plans because you want consistency, you're going to miss out on a lot of possible opportunities. The companies that are embracing that hacker spirit of allowing people to get off the beaten path and try something crazy are the ones that find the weird bugs that don't happen when you're just using it the way the developer intended. Certainly, from the perspective of how video games influence this, I would say that a lot of the folks that are, how do I say this? I just find a lot of overlap. A lot of folks that are open-minded about how to go about testing something also tend to be kind of open-minded about video games too.
Sure. No, I think that says a lot too, because you look at the security industry and obviously there's some amount of, truth behind how much need there is for, you know, talent, how much need there is for filling jobs. And at the same time, you're seeing, you know, these crazy layoffs and other things that are going on. But one of the takeaways I'm kind of pulling out of this is that there's a lot of really talented people out there that may not have a traditional approach to security that would be really, really effective in a team that is focused on similar types of outcomes, right? If they're looking to find these vulnerabilities to fix them or whatever, like consider, you know, people that are coming or have experience in these other communities, because they could be like a huge asset without any really like on paper something that would be attractive from a typical, you know, business.
Yeah, and conversely to that point, people who are already in a cybersecurity career path or have interest in any kind of reverse engineering or any kind of hacking that might involve attacking a system would benefit greatly from playing around with making a tool-assisted speedrun and using that safe environment to find these glitches. The reason I say that is because there are very few places where you can hack something new that's not just a Hack the Box or a Try Hack Me or one of those other sites where it's you kind of know it's going to be curated. You kind of know that it's going to have that je ne sais quoi. I don't know how to phrase it. Or even if you're competing in a CTF, you kind of know that it's a deliberate environment. Whereas this is a safe place where it's the Wild West. You can go wild on a game that's really obscure and find the craziest stuff. You can, in this really safe environment where you're not going to get hurt or hurt anyone else, you can try to your heart's content, and at any time you blow something up, you just back up, reload, and try again with no consequences. So even for folks that are already in a cybersecurity career path, it's a great way to expand your skills in a totally unique environment.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that I haven't really thought about before. You know, when I'm talking to students and people that are trying to break into the industry or try to find other alternative paths for skill development, I would typically point them to some of those things, like you said, like the Try Hack Me, the Hack the Box, or even start looking into the bug bounty space, because in those cases, obviously you can try and hack on actual production or at least, you know, live systems, live companies, with the caveat that you need to disclose those vulnerabilities. So it does give you some hands-on skills, but I didn't really think of the game aspect as being another area where they could safely, you know, approach vulnerability research, exploit development, those types of things.
Absolutely.
Now, before we get into a little bit of this, the main story here, where I want to talk about the Zelda video that you sent me a while ago, I just wanted to ask one other thing here. Over time, as you've been involved in the community there, like, how has the approach to doing this research, to doing these vulnerability tests, has that like really changed over time? Has it become more sophisticated? Like, how has that community grown since you've been involved?
Just to make sure, how has which community
like
grown?
The TASBOT community, the speedrunning community, those areas where we were talking about before?
I started the TASBOT community in 2013, and it was just a couple of scrappy folks on the TAS Videos website trying to shove stuff together in time for a charity event. It was pretty scrappy. Over the last decade plus, it's developed into its own standalone community. In addition to or alongside partnering with the TAS Videos community. And it's become quite the force. I am blessed every day to have some of the absolutely brilliant minds in that community. Everything from emulator developers to the folks that know how to do 3D printing to make TASBOT, or the 3D modeling that happened, the code to make these wonderful eye animations. And I mean, it's amazing how much different effort was needed. Just the eye board alone, this circuit board production, was its own unique challenge. So having that diverse community has just been incredible. It's also grown in size. The first charity event we did, I think the whole event raised $100,000 in 2014. And by, I believe it was 2018, we had a single TASBOT block of content that raised $100,000 in 1 hour. It was just incredible. It's now raised over $1.5 million for everything from Doctors Without Borders, the Prevent Cancer Foundation. We've worked with National Alliance on Mental Illness for mental health care resources. It's just been an incredible journey. And it wouldn't have been possible without the wide variety of subject matter experts, because frankly, there is no way for me to know everything about all of those different industries, industry aspects and nuances. There's just no way. There's too many facets to it.
So for somebody that's like really interested in getting involved with it, what resources would you point them to?
So please feel free, if you have any interest in seeing a tool-assisted speedrun played back on a real console, or if you just want to see a whole lot of really fascinating hackers in a wonderful environment, the best place to connect is discord.gg/TASBOT. The TASBOT Discord server is one of the more unique servers in the sense that it is a PG server. We don't have foul language there except for one channel, but it causes people to rethink how to talk to one another, and it's a much more pleasant environment. We have a couple of channels dedicated specifically to hacking, hardware hacking, things like that. So that's the best place to go. You can find more information about TaskBot in general at task.bot. The task.bot website is our wiki. It's amazing we were able to get that domain name. And I'm also have TaskBot as task.bot on Blue Sky if you just want to follow news updates.
Oh, nice.
But you can certainly find more information there.
I appreciate that. So let's get into kind of like the big story here relating to the reason that we ended up getting together, right? We met a few years back in person, finally at DEF CON, one of the largest hacking conventions in the world. We had gotten synced up due to mutual work that we had been doing prior to that. And you were trying to explain to me initially this video that you did a live stream on. It was for the event? Was it Games Done Quick or was it a different one?
Yes, that was Summer Games Done Quick 2022, and I was at DEF CON presenting on what we had found.
Yes, so we had talked about that, and honestly, it took probably two or three explanations before I fully was able to wrap my mind around it. But you were telling me to set it up a little bit. About a bug that you found in The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time on N64, and that you and your team had put together, instead of just leveraging it to beat the game faster, you did something completely unexpected with that. So I'm just going to let you tell it because you obviously can tell the story much better, but like set this up for us.
So I need to start with a little bit of backdrop. As I mentioned, how different communities came up with their own categories. The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time community came up with a couple of categories involving which glitches could be used. There were glitches involving a reverse bottle glitch route and some other bizarrely named categories because of how broken Ocarina of Time could be. But one of the ways that a few folks in that community found to break the game involved a way of doing an arbitrary code execution. And the initial method just jumped straight to the end credits, similar to the explanation I gave for Super Mario Bros. 3, but using entirely different entry point methods. Still arbitrary code execution, but the way they did it was a use after free mechanism that in the community is known as a stale reference manipulation. At the time, all you could do with it was simply jump to the end credits. A couple of researchers discovered ways of getting a little bit more control, but it was very difficult to do, even with practice. So very, very few people could actually pull that off. Around that time, someone named Soren came along and decided to do a beta showcase for Ocarina of Time and approached me at a Games Done Quick in person and said, hey, I would like to do this. And I have all of these ideas of what I want to show. But the problem is some of these ideas only work on real hardware and don't work in an emulator because emulators... it's very, very difficult to make a good emulator for a Nintendo 64. It's just a very complicated processor setup and layout. So he kind of wanted to do something with the real hardware and said, hey, I can't do it in just an emulator. I need TaskBot to help. And in the process, we also discovered that it was impossible for us with just TaskBot to play the game in a way where we could do it all ourselves. We basically discovered through a couple of years of research that it took both a human player getting to a point of reaching that ace entry point, along with TaskBot doing button presses faster than any human could, to combine with our knowledge of the game to present a story that made sense. So we started on a very interesting path of trying to combine all of these elements to show this beta showcase. So in 2021, we started the process of stitching everything together. And we had to get this arbitrary code execution perfectly worked out. If you would like to know more details about how that actually works, I highly recommend watching the Retro Game Mechanics Explained video on what we called Triforce Percent, which was the name of the project, Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time Triforce Percent. OOT Triforce Percent does use a really complex method of getting Link in a specific area, faced a specific direction, storing his direction in a certain way there's a rock involved that has its own direction information, unculling an object by pointing the camera in just a specific way, getting all of that set up just right and then pausing the game using something called pause buffering, getting all of those elements in just the right circumstance with a human effort, then switching over to TaskBot and unpausing the game. At that moment, we're able to use that little bit of bootstrap code to work our way up to total control of the console using this use after free glitch. There's a wonderful bit of explanation that I gave at a DEF CON talk in at DEF CON 2023, I want to say, about how all of that process works. I won't try to recount it all here because it's frankly so complicated that you pretty much need a visual aid. It was a very, very complex series of movements and button presses and then extra code. But at the end of the day, it allowed us to press buttons on controllers with TaskBot and store that information in memory to execute later.
And as a result, what I ended up seeing, and I'm going to show a clip from this, from that Games Done Quick showcase there, which was an hour long explanation and kind of demonstration of all this. You ended up just creating brand new content in the game that was executing on the original hardware based on TaskBot, just programming it with button presses as it was, like, essentially to build all that content and then to execute it on the system.
See,
we effectively wrote a movie inside of the game. And yes, what we presented at Summer Games Done Quick 2022 was a beta showcase. We did show off beta content that really was on the cartridge. But we also added additional elements to stitch together various fan theories and early, early misdirection in the 90s, people creating fan content that wasn't really in the game, and also stitching together things that Nintendo had shown, the reason we called it Triforce Percent is because an ad from Nintendo was released that showed Link getting the Triforce in Ocarina of Time. But when the game came out, there was an area of the pause screen with a Triforce that looked like it could be filled in just like the other elements in the game. But at no point in the game can you ever get the Triforce and fill that portion of the game menu in. So they had a video, a promo video, an advertisement from Nintendo promoting Ocarina of Time, showing Link getting the Triforce in a Triforce room. And we wanted to recreate that based on what Nintendo had done. So we did. We made a movie combining all of these different beta elements and all of these fan theories and all of these fan songs into a storyline with dialogue writers contributing, voice actors contributing. We had 3D, new 3D models we made in Blender and imported into the game just through button presses alone. And then a big finale that I won't spoil. You should watch it yourself. But we put more than just the Triforce in the game.
Yeah, it was just such an incredible video. Definitely going to link to it and show a little bit of a clip there, in the post-production here to show that part off. But just such a really cool thing. And it just blew me away at how, what's possible with just the game hacking stuff itself. And that it's just a whole area of, just accessibility for anybody that's interesting to just dive in and start poking around a little bit.
Absolutely. That particular event might be unsurpassable for us. It was more than two and a half years, roughly, about 24 people involved over the course of that time. It was a massive undertaking. It was exhausting. I don't know if I would go about it the same way, but at the same time, it was something that might make you cry. It is emotionally impactful, and it helped raise over $228,000 for Doctors Without Borders in 1 hour of content. So I will never forget what
we did
there.
That's just incredible. Well, Alan, I wanted to wrap this up with a couple different finalized questions for you, mostly for the businesses out there. We talked a little bit about, the types of things that they should do if they were, building software and trying to protect those things. Any other advice, based on the history that you've had in cybersecurity with games, with whatever, like tips for businesses, like what's your go-to strategies for businesses that can, implement practical solutions to try and secure themselves? This is more of a cybersecurity question than a gaming question, of course.
Man, think like a hacker. I know that doesn't help, but really, okay, I'll phrase it this way. If you are a business and you have a website, a network, an application, a web app, something like that, maybe even a mobile app, you are exposing a surface area. And when you have a surface area that is exposed, you can expect that someone out there is going to try to do something nefarious with it. If your internal team is running the exact same tests exactly the same way, you're not going to get a solid understanding of how your infrastructure is vulnerable. You really need an external look, not the developers who wrote the code looking at it, just like how you need an external test engineer or test team looking at code or looking at how your application runs. You need an external fresh look. It can be someone else in your own company. It can be a separate team. But it's also helpful to have that external hacker look. And I know that I am somewhat self-serving, given that I am a security consultant doing external security assessments, but I can't understate how important it is. If you have the same people writing the code that are trying to suss out how secure it is, you will not get a good view of what your code is doing and how exposed you really are. I guess allow a hacker culture in. Allow those external out-of-the-box perspectives to percolate in some way, whether that is having an external assessment or having a team with the authority to have root on their systems, to have the ability to use it to attack you. You'll learn a lot more that way.
Now, one of the approaches that I really feel kind of passionate about is that collaborative approach with a company that is looking to improve their security or to reduce their risk, because we know that you can't eliminate it entirely. You have to minimize it to the most significant extent that you can either afford to, or that's practical to do so. What's your take on the collaborative aspect of it versus like the, how you would say like a black box test versus like a white box test, how much information you're gathering, or how much information you're provided ahead of time, how much context around that? Like what's your take on that?
So I'm a little bit of a maverick here. I come from over 2 decades of test engineering experience, and not specifically just security consulting. That was more intermixed as things went on. In the context-driven, context-aware approach to test engineering, you don't try to use a one-size-fits-all approach. You look at what you're trying to test, and then you assess what's the best approach to go about it. There are different principles to it that are more or less applicable in a given assessment. But in general, you kind of want to dive in and quit. You want to try to explore areas that maybe haven't been covered as much, try the things that aren't as well trodden, stuff like that. But overall, what I'm actually getting at is if you're approaching it with the developer that already knows everything about the code, and it's a fully what would basically a white box, a wide open setup where you know everything about the code already, you're going to miss things because you already know how the code is supposed to work. What we're trying to find is ways that it doesn't work the way you expect. Or to say it differently, on a game like this is a read-only memory. It's not changing. There is nothing that can be updated. The developer can't make any changes. We are only finding flaws in code as it was written. If this video game console and video game setup is going to work exactly the way the developer wrote the code, it's just perhaps we can make it work in ways they didn't expect it. So kind of a long-winded way of saying, if you have the same people that are already familiar with it, testing it, they're probably not going to find anything new because they've already looked it over. On the other side of the equation, if you go to perform a security assessment and you say, this is a completely black box, you have to figure out everything on your own. That is a completely viable approach. And in fact, I highly recommend starting there. It allows for exploration. It allows for trying to do things wrong, basically doing things in an incorrect way that the developers didn't expect. However, and this is a key part, if you also give that consultant the ability, when the time is right, to themselves look at that code for the first time, look at it fresh, do a code-assisted assessment, or provide additional context they can look at, maybe provide hey, these were the findings we found last time. Not for you to look at right up front, but to look at after you've already had a look for yourself, just to see other areas that might be useful or fruitful to look in. It provides so much more fertile ground to go explore. I would still encourage everyone to start any assessment and treat it as a black box assessment for at least a couple of hours, if nothing else. But that moment where you can start to look a little bit deeper, maybe peek into the code, maybe run a couple of different assessment tools on it that can help you spot possible areas where maybe memory isn't being protected correctly, or there are credentials that are exposed in places they shouldn't be. That information can be key to cracking open something that you wouldn't find as easily. If you are facing a very well-equipped attacker, in other words, you have a website and you are, for whatever reason, in an industry that might be a target, you can expect that a potentially large group of very resourceful hackers might be trying to attack you right now. But when you're doing an assessment, you're only giving those assessors a few hours, maybe a few days, a week or two if you're lucky. When you have that limited time frame, that time-boxed engagement, anything you can do to get as much out of that time as possible is helpful. So I highly encourage starting black box, but providing source code and providing those additional resources such as past engagements and notes that might help, so that it helps inform what direction and what context to approach that test in. I know that was a long-winded explanation, but all of those pieces.
No, I think that it makes a lot of sense. I think that there's a lot of really good advice in there. Just from a business owner's perspective, just understanding why they should take a specific approach and kind of the benefits. You want to, like you said, you really want to weigh the objectives that you're doing and leverage the skill sets of the people that you're bringing in the most effective manner. So I think you're right at, giving them the context of, previous work or maybe their own concerns or things like that, and giving them more resources than maybe an attacker would have to make better use of their time, but also for them to go after it and just kind of get a look at things to see what kind of, piques their interest. I've noticed with my assessments that I've done, right away, things start to just scratch my brain a little bit, like, oh, I want to look at that a little bit because it acted just slightly off from what I anticipated. And then I'm going to, I'm going to make a note and I'm going to go back to it. And then later on, if I can't crack that, then, working with the customer to dive in a little bit more sometimes bears a lot more fruit than me just getting frustrated or going down some sort of weird rabbit hole.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Alan, as we wrap up here, what do you have going on? What's coming up? Any events? Any new showcases? Anything like that you're doing? Sorry.
That's okay. One of the most interesting things we are working on is this is a Super Nintendo, and we have replaced the audio processing unit clock with our own replacement board here. We did that to assess how changing the speed manually might change how the console behaves. But recently we asked console owners themselves to run a test on their consoles and put out a survey on Blue Sky, got over 140 responses, still as a couple more are still trickling in right now even. That helped us assess that there are some components aging on a Super Nintendo. Now, you don't have to be panicked. Nothing is horrible. Your audio might play a little bit off pitch, not the worst thing in the world. What's fascinating is how it has changed and how different it is from one console to another and how that interacts with temperatures. So stay tuned for us. We're working on releasing a report on what we found. This matters a lot for us when we're making tool-assisted speedruns that play back on real hardware because we want those consoles to run in a deterministic way. And that aging process is causing them to behave in an even more non-deterministic way than they already do. So those elements matter to us. So we're doing some research that might affect other aspects, other elements outside of the sphere of playing back a tool-assisted speedrun on real consoles. If you would like to get into that, by the way, you can get your own replay device or build your own. The hardware is all open source. It's on PCBWay. You can order your own. We're also trying to get some in stock. We don't make a ton of money on this or anything. It's a cottage industry. But feel free to swing by the discord.gg/taskbot community if you have any interest in seeing a tool-assisted speedrun playing back on your own console.
Well, I appreciate your time, Alan. Really appreciate all that insight into the game stuff. Look forward to seeing you again, probably on the DEF CON stage, if nothing else, with some really interesting research that you've been working on with your team there. So keep at it, and I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Many thanks to Alan, aka Duango AC, for sharing his journey into cybersecurity and all that crazy information about speedrunning, video game hacking, and just security in general. Everything here would not be possible without the assistance of the production team here at Growth Mode Content. So thanks to Matt Mazur, Mike Brindisi, Danny Tripodi for all the production assistance here, and everybody else behind the scenes that helped make this happen. If anything today was really kind of sparking your interest, obviously I'd be remiss to not mention about Meltech Solutions and, you know, how we operate in the cybersecurity space. So if you're really interested in learning a little bit more about, you know, how your company might be vulnerable, or you want to assess your vulnerabilities and, you know, kind of see how you can minimize your risk, you know, feel free to reach out to us at meltechsolutions.com or contact at Meltech Solutions. This podcast here covers real stories about the security world. So if you have like an interesting story to share about a hack that you uncovered, about an incident that you were part of, or kind of anything related to that, let us know. We really want to hear these stories and kind of break them down, discuss them, and talk about, you know, the factors that led up to these and how businesses can learn from those and protect themselves. So until next time, stay safe. Remember, understanding how systems get broken is the first step to keeping them whole. So this is Hack Dissection.